Well, there are many questions that run through one's mind as a critic when you wander through an exhibition. What does this mean? Do I like it? Am I being moved? Is this saying to me like the statue in that sonnet by Rilke, "You must change your life"? Am I going to run out of this exhibition and change my life? I wonder if I was the only person wandering around marching through this exhibition of Matthew Day Jackson at Houser and Worth thinking, what did this cost? The sheer technology deployed without even reading any of the advanced publicity, just by looking, just by knowing anything, and you don't have to know anything about art, you just have to have built a new bathroom in your house to know that this must have cost about as much as a national building a new national museum in some Central European state. The utter phenomenal craftsmanship, the fabricators, what has gone in to make such an exhibition? That maybe is the wrong question to ask in relation to art. It's just the artist or dealer or collector's business what this happened to have cost or necessitated. But then those of us who have been trained at all in, say, the art of the Renaissance or in any kind of art history, and anybody who makes art, part of the experience of looking at art is it's intricately related to the process of making it and all the related issues to relating it. Ara, did you have any qualms about the sheer scale and artistry and expense material characteristics of this exhibition, or were you able to just see straight through that and get to a deeply satisfying aesthetic experience?
A loaded question. I always think of Day Jackson as sort of the Discovery Channel meets Marcel Duchamp or something like that. In terms of its material or aesthetic pleasures, he's obviously a very thinking artist and one whose conceptual interests are matched, obviously, for a deep sort of care for the craft of his objects. As I think we can tell from the rapidly shifting texture, scale, materials, and media of his work, in some ways, what you love about an artist can also be, to a certain extent, a kind of liability, such that he really, in some ways, kind of embodies this, what, you know, for a good couple of decades now, Rosalind Krauss has called the post-medium condition, right? That the artist is not necessarily beholden to any parameters other than a kind of almost sort of rapidly shifting oscillation, in a sense. And some part of me oftentimes wants him to sort of sit still and explore a little bit more one of these channels a little bit more thoroughly and sort of, this show in particular was very much a kind of smorgasbord, and I think your word scale sort of sums up the almost Wagnerian kind of dimensions, which are matched by the spaces of Houser and Worth, which kind of almost demand that sort of scale, I guess those were my basic impressions.
Roberta, was it the overall spirit of this exhibition that grabbed you, or were there works that were able, whose use of materials or the actual materials that were able to, how did you engage with the material aspect here?
Well, you know, this is the show to hate this month, which is kind of saddening in a way, and it's really been so disparaged. And I hate to get on the bandwagon join in, but there really wasn't anything that appealed to me. I mean, I just was looking at this kind of intersection of material and skill and certain kinds of ideas And there's obviously a drive for the work to be very accessible, but there just wasn't really any there for me. And I just felt really, I felt bad for him because I feel like a number of artists are getting, I mean, I've liked some of his previous work. I think he has a very peculiar sense of material and he really wants craft to be sort of very available and to evoke different traditions. But a lot of things that you look at today are an artist that gets a little too ahead of himself and has too much money and the pressure to fill too much space. And so that I felt like he just disappeared, really, that he just wasn't there as a person. I could sort of see his interest, but there was all this reliance on other artists and on technologies that seemed so much beyond what he could manage with his own hands. Not that I want to romanticize that or limit somebody, but David's reaction is, it's a reaction I have a lot, and I usually take it as a sign that, you know, I don't really care how much something costs. I want that to be pushed to the background when I'm thinking about a work of art. And so if it's there in the foreground, you know sort of you've got a problem and you stick with it and you look at it and you try to hope it'll go to the background, but it doesn't, it actually doesn't. So I just thought there were a lot of kind of reliance on, you know, the Bruce Nauman piece, the big shelves that look like Damien Hirst, the kind of abuse of Rodin and the Burghers of Calais, and then things that are completely, well, even they're not completely anonymous because there's a, like the what's that called, the three-part one where it turned.
Oh, yes, that sort of like an advertising display.
Yeah, so at a certain point that looks like a corporate lobby, and then you're looking at a painting which is Bierstadt's, which you realize you've seen a couple of times already, or at least once. It's just, you know.
The catalog, I think, could go on, because actually one of the YBAs, I think it's maybe Simon or Patterson or Richard Patterson, has made work using that kind of flip-flop, that display technique. And it seemed to me, you know, almost disingenuous that, yeah, Rodin, Michelangelo, it's taken for granted. And of course, that's part of the whole lexicon of the number of artists who use old masters of that nature, it goes without saying. Bruce Nauman is mentioned in the title. That's very nice. But, you know, Mark Quinn doesn't get a credit. And those vitrines with the skeletons and what looked like a body of frozen blood are really just a bit of a rehash of a relatively minor, but, you know, nonetheless inventive current artist. So it seemed to me it wasn't just homage to the masters, but helping oneself to the minor masters, which seemed a bit unsavory. Am I being too harsh, Stephen? I think we're looking to you, perhaps, to champion. I think you're a natural for Matthew J. Jackson. Use the mic.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. All
right. Well, I sort of echo Roberta's sentiment. I feel that it's a melancholy task, I think, really dissecting this show. I'm a painter, so I think about, I still like aura, can't help it. I don't know, I felt defeated, you know, walking out, and I didn't even stop for an espresso in their coffee bar, and I think part of it is, I think this show is bearing the brunt of a lot of built-up antagonism towards a kind of dioramic scale of festival art that, I don't know, Roberta, did you coin that term, festival art?
No, Peter Sheldahl did.
Peter Sheldahl did, yeah. And I sort of detected the master's hand in the New Yorker dissection of this show.
Dissection also, or bludgeon?
Dental treatment from Marathon Man. I think when you have a team of assistants executing work with materials that are shipped in on an industrial scale, most likely aura is going to escape you. Now, this is not true to my mind, for Richard Serra. But Richard Serra knows a lot about scale. Mm-hmm. He knows a lot about the operations of scale, and he seems to have a direct way of addressing the body. In a kind of grab bag sort of survey type installation like this was, there was no way to feel that as an embodied sensibility, as I feel myself to be when I'm in a show, that I was being addressed by the work in any kind of way. I was kind of an ornament to the work. And there was something ultimately kind of, you know, corporate about it. And, you know, what signifies, you know, that adjective, I think, and, you know, that it used in a discouraging way, I think, is that, you know, the work feels cold in relationship to what we think about when we think of art as something. I'm not saying it's not art, but it's just when we think about art as an opportunity for human expression. I mean, there's stuff. There was texture, but there was no aura. There was texture, but no hand. Mm. The thing was heavily textured, lots and lots of texture, texture all over the place.
But it was literal. It was literal texture, wasn't it?
It was manufactured texture, and so I, you know, so in the same way that I feel like in a corporate lobby. Looking at maybe decorative panels of texture that are meant to invoke wood or water, like the big scholar's rock that was mm-hmm. in this show. I felt the over scale of the work wasn't lightened by a sense of, to my mind, of irony. Mm-hmm. And I think that in fact that may be sort of one of the keys to unlocking the show, mm-hmm. because I also feel the show is very much about the body being, you know, one of the subjects of the show is very much about the body being under siege by mortality, by time, by injury, by and being exposed, and by scale. Mm. But somehow it doesn't translate into any kind of sympathetic connective tissue
right.
for the viewing sensibility.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Ara, if I could turn back to you. When we have, we've had in the last half century, an escalating tradition of artists going beyond merely maintaining a studio with some assistance to the factory phenomenon. Mm. But it strikes me, and especially as you cited Duchamp in your opening remarks, that whether it's Warhol, of course, or Damien Hirst or Jeff Koons or Mark Kostarby, there are artists who have big factories where the mode of production is folded into the meaning of the work, so that it's not that you stand back and say, scandal, did you hear Jeff Koons worked with some assistants? But no, the work is almost is about its own slickness, or Hirst is about its own facture. But the problem I think that Stephen was describing is one that there's no real intentional artistic thought behind the deployment of the expertise of others. Would you go along with that, or would you?
Yeah, I mean, I think Stephen pretty much summed it up by essentially underscoring the lack of irony, right? I mean, all of those artists that we might think of that thematize their own, the lack of craft or the lack of their hand or they're phoning it in, from Duchamp to Manzoni, also really sort of the crux of their work becomes not simply the work itself, but the ideas that it unleashes, right? That's really the crux of conceptual art. If you turn to the press release, it's about a 4-page, completely unironic, earnest explication of every move of every object, which I think is telling, right? That there is not a kind of ironic relinquishment of the hand. There is a simultaneous kind of fetishization of texture and of the object and its materiality and its making, and an attempt to kind of thematize these grand ideas about alienation and destruction. And I think the artist sort of wants to have both. He wants to have his conceptual cake and eat the object as well. And I think we've kind of come to why it doesn't quite perhaps work.
With a small side of minor artists, is that
they provide the greens.
And even some Eve Klein blue.
Exactly. But I want to answer one thing. I'm interested in one thing you said, because I don't think that it's the difference between whether the artist makes it or not. In other words, what Stephen was saying about Sarah,
I mean, I think Duchamp has aura. Duchamp has touch. Judd has touch for me. That it's just translated in what you get. You know, maybe touch isn't the right word, but maybe another word we don't use so much, the sensibility.
Well, affect maybe is.
Well, sensibility.
Is
you feel there's a person in there, and that the whole thing has sort of been thought through.
Mm-hmm.
And what you had with Day Jackson Moore was all these kind of weird textures, and then you suddenly realize that there was nobody behind them, that there were lots of signs of touch, but they were kind of mass-produced in a certain way.
Well, I think it's also that in some sense, any kind of real appearance of the hand then becomes a slip. And particularly in work's desire to be transparent to a kind of limited sense of ambiguities around the referent, you know? Mm-hmm. And so what happens, so then what happens is that without irony, which of course is basically the operation of ambiguity in many ways, you have a kind of resacralization of the referent. So there's this kind of gee whiz quality around everything, which I can't handle that. I'm an anti-literalist.
They look sort of, some of the especially those large scale, sort of overwrought wooden pieces mixed with collage looked like a kind of corporate Dada, sort of in a sense. I mean, they seem almost reified in a sense and made over into something.
Or Nevelson. I mean, they were just like you know, all that, if you really got up close, I mean, not that she really made surfaces like that, but there was the lead, twine, string, all that, you know. I mean, what I do is you look at these things and you think, well, what is this? And then you read, at least they didn't do mixed medium.
Oh, yes,
I appreciated the list of everything. The checklist
was an education, wasn't it? I mean,
I appreciated that, and I was really tracking a lot of it down.
Tracking cutting.
That's like laser cutting. It's like a still version of CGI in film. And, you know, if you look at CGI from 10 years ago, the very thing that made me used to go, like, wow, you know, look at that explosion. I don't know how they survived that.
Yeah.
And now, you know, 10 years later, it's like, oh, I can see the seams. I can see the superimposition.
Yeah.
And so, you know, today's explosions look so much more real. But 10 years from now, they're, you know, there are those seams. I can see them. So, of course,
I think one of my students was explaining to me or giving his interpretation, or perhaps he'd read somewhere, that the Rodin was actually fabricated using some sort of 3D type printing technique from his own cell phone shots of the burghers of Calais.
There's a 3D.
And so that's actually, so that Thomas Schutter-like look of the melting figures is therefore perhaps part of, there at least this is the semblance of some meaning that has to do with facture, that has to do with, you know, A strange kind of digital adjustment leading to an unmonumental monumentalism. And so that potentially had interest. I think we now need to do that. Stephen mentioned the dissection. We now need to do, having, I think, come to a fairly swift consensus concerning the merit of the show, let's set ourselves this challenge. Okay, what was the best bit? Is there anything that we could take away from the show? If there's one piece, or if we said to, we might not actually have room for it in our living room, so take away as a metaphorical. If we were to say to Day Jackson, if we were to meet him in the street, perhaps he's standing outside, and we will have to meet him in the street. Okay, he'll say to us, all right, I get the message, but what did you like? You know, what should I improve? What should I work further with? Is there a piece that for any of us came closest to satisfactory aesthetic experience? Stephen?
I had one moment, and it wasn't really the piece so much, but the juxtaposition of the racing car, the drag racing car, suspended above the hallway with the highway line, which I believe was put in there for Mary Heilman. And so that juxtaposition, I thought, was pretty funny. But that was sort of me bringing my own sort of sensibility, you know, my own sort of sensibility to it. So I beyond that, the other thing I would say is that around the Rodin,
the degradation. I think there's something being said about the degradation of the experience of the Gestalt through media and the broadcast of media. And there's an idea there.
Yes.
And I'm not sure, maybe it should be written about, again, because it's so literal. I don't, you know, some ideas are just, you know, would make really interesting passages in a Thomas Bernhard novel or something, but not really work for, as an actual, you know, recapitulation as a piece. But I got the idea of the degradation of the Gestalt.
Right. Ara, a piece that you would say to Amy Menon, say, hey,
well,
do more of them?
I think one of the threads that of his work that I have appreciated in the past is this exploration of the sort of display case as, you know, from the tradition of the kind of the Wunderkammer up until, you know, the present day sort of shop window as the site of both wonder and terror, right, of the pleasures of examination and the horrors of positivism. And, you know, there was something about those sort of écorché bodies and different materials that I found actually aesthetically pleasurable. But again, they were so disjointed from the rest of the show, you know, the scale of which seemed suited more to sort of the arsenal in Venice than to, you know, an actual human space that it's hard to sort of take that away.
Roberta.
Well, I feel like that when you would go to an artist studio, I would often sort of try to find the work I liked the best, and I feel like that's what you're asking me to do now.
Yeah.
Sort of, it's this kind of relativism.
It is, yes. We've established individually and collectively our verdict, which is not so positive, but within
I would go for something small and highly detailed, which would be parts of the skeletons, and then maybe certain of the heads opposite the skeletons, where there was a real relationship between, or there, you could find a kind of relationship between the scale of the piece and the size of the piece and the material. You know, that it was just. I think one of the reasons you might like the skeletons too is that they were just kind of stripped down.
Yeah,
they were bare. You could see them and through them in a certain way.
Yes.
But the smaller ones, I think, I would prefer.
I realize I better answer it myself. You know, I just on a purely formal level, and then at a sort of maybe empathy level, the reliefs done by that CTC method, which always amuses me because it also stands in my mind for crush, tear, curl, which is a technique of tea production. But that laser cut textured relief where he has Paris and Yves Klein blue with the Seine and other bodies of water and sort of Yves Klein coppery oxidization in a way that has a kind of medieval feeling, but it's medieval via Klein. So that and the sort of Alberto Burri meets Louise Nevelson, plus a lot of Mark Bradford, not so easy to acknowledge, in the sort of cityscapes. But it's this sort of phoned in, or it's a sort of algorithm of influence leading to something that's got some texture, but it's only a literal texture. So I don't know. Might be back to the drawing board for Mr. Today Jackson. So our next show is one where one might also start with exactly the same reaction. What did this cost? But did it cost more than $50? We've gone from Milgo Bufkin's dream job to the laundry's nightmare job. But that's to offer a trivial way into Anna Betbie's. Roberta, what do you make of her show?
Well, she sort of made a splash last year making these paintings out of hides that had been sort of abused and penetrated and painted on, burned. And I thought they were really kind of interesting. I thought they had this great, weird presence. And some kind of possibility. So when I walked into this show, I was really sort of shocked and initially quite disappointed in a way. And I stayed there a while, and then there were some other people in, and I don't know. I came away really happy that she decided she wasn't going to stick with these things, which she could probably, you know, sell quite a few of over the next 5 or 10 years, that she was going to really strike out someplace else, and that she was announcing this kind of interest in really intense color. She still is very nervous about just traditional paint on canvas, and, you know, that's something I'd like to see her work out of, you know. But, and I had this appreciation, like I said, I thought the color was fantastic, and this kind of idea of making something that you have a very mixed reaction to, like the color's great in this sort of retinal sense, and then what is the object, you know, what is that thing? It's like old towels. And so I like that kind of perversity. I felt like she was saying goodbye to the fur paintings with the big hand in the middle of the floor that people could sit on. And I thought probably I liked what was going on in some of the bathrobes, but that I didn't like the idea. I mean, it was great for people to put them on, but that somebody was going to buy one as a painting just struck me as kind of strange. So I kind of came away feeling much better about it than I did at first. And that, you know, that she's, it's like a, whatever they call it, a sophomore show, you know, and from somebody that you kind of expected more from, and she just sort of said, okay, you know, stop it right there. I don't want that kind of career. And I want to be a little less, I'm going to resist this a bit. And it was, so in a way, I'm more interested in it for these kind of ephemeral things, like I like color, or I don't want to fit into this slot, you know, as expressions of attitude almost.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very interesting take. It's the one that's it's the almost the anti-Day Jackson kind of approach to thinking through medium and relationship to it.
Well, she is thinking about how much this costs, and she doesn't have a lot of money, and you know
right.
That,
okay, right.
Sorry.
No. But I've left that behind now. We're past the dollars and cents.
Well, she has a good deal of money now because a lot of them have sold for
right.
quite
of these
of the actual bathrobe sold individually for $18,000.
Did you try one on?
I did not. I didn't know that was an option.
Right.
But the bathrobes, I would know. Not that, you know, the quantification of the work necessarily impinges upon its value, but those, you know, they may have cost less than $50 to make, but they earned her a good $17,000 something plus for each.
In total, because they were only $3,800.
Okay, split that in half. Yeah. But, you know, that said, she's essentially soaked some terry cloth bathrobes in some dye and burned a couple. And, I might have spoken out of turn, but I thought that the wall hangings were actually quite compelling and had a kind of engagement with this Hans Hofmann-like mid-century abstraction, a real kind of attention to how they were knit together and a play of the planes. And I thought that the sort of center of the show just absolutely failed entirely to really engage with that in any profound way. I thought the sort of squishy hand in the center was... seemed kind of gratuitous in a sense.
And, oh, really? All right. You didn't bind it together?
I didn't.
But couldn't it, just from a functional point of view, one could recline on it and get a different feeling for the hanging pieces, no?
Well, it's sort of about with the bathrobes.
Yes.
Yeah. One could also buy it for an absurd amount of money, right?
I mean, right.
It's, it just didn't seem terribly to sort of fit in with what she was trying to do on the wall, I guess.
Stephen, did you view this primarily as painting by eccentric means, or did you see it as more to do with a kind of appropriation art? What was your take on this?
Well, a combination of the two. The hand. I like looking at the hand in the photograph because it looks like it's made out of coconut. but it was like, you know, that fake fur stuff, and I couldn't help but think of Nayland Blake's, you know, large bunny bed. that predates it by a number of years, and it's roughly in the same scale as an object in a room. So I don't, the hand interested me the least. I became more interested in the towel paintings. I was most interested in the towel paintings. Mm-hmm. And I think there could be more exploration about in a Hoffman-esque way. I mean, all she really needs to do is in substituting dye for paint, is then bring that back to painting in some way, and see what happens. I think the towel skins, once you identify them as towels, there's a bit of an incremental letdown in terms of, again, a kind of literal referent in the process. But what's positive about that is that there's a sense of the availability of the process, within the very tiny cottage industry that is a young artist's, studio, mm-hmm. and who doesn't have a lot of money. So there was a nice sort of juxtaposition of a kind of reach of historical reference, mm-hmm. But a kind of concrete play. I like their scale. The scale may have been a little bit big for that room. I think a lot of artists, project their work into rooms. Like we're in our studio, and our studio is utterly inadequate to the vision that we have for it. But when we're projecting our work into the room, I think one of the things that we want to do is we want to be very sure of the room that we're projecting it into. Dimensions variable, And
isn't that to over-glorify the whole institution of the gallery show? Because that's to make it seem that she's made that body of work to be savored almost exclusively in the Kate.
Well, this is where I'm not sure because I think it. Running the own narrative in my head, I thought, well, it's like she got, there was an anxiety expressed to my mind with the center pillow hand, mm-hmm. That was like, well, this is not enough. So uh-huh. I'm going to give you a little bit of this, and then the robes are a little bit of, mm-hmm. and I think that the silence of the spaces in mm-hmm. in the large towel scapes, geometric Hoffman-esque scapes. It would have been interesting just to sort of see what would happen if I was if I'd had a chance to be alone with them.
Yeah, but my suspicion is that I had sort of generally warm feelings towards the spirit of the show, but my suspicion is that actually, if you just looked at them as paintings that happened to choose terry cloth and dye over canvas and Winsor & Newton or Williamsburg paint, to me that's that could be, but isn't, a minor issue. It would be a minor issue if one then had to engage image by image around the show and decide, this is working, this is moving me, this color, it could be more here, this could be less there. But I actually don't think there was that much of the formal decision making that perhaps Stephen.
Well, I think what I'm suggesting, in fact, is that there's an anxiety about whether that was enough that then gets addressed by putting other things in.
Right. So the support is a gimmick that, to some extent, is apologizing for the act of painting.
Yeah, to some extent. But I also think there's a spirit of inventiveness and a kind of, let's try it on. There's a spirit of experimentation that is kind of nice. I'm reminded, it seems a lot of my students really like her, and I should say that they seem liberated into doing things that are not like her by her, by the recognition of her work.
And
I also see Polly Applebaum, like obviously in the dying, but Polly gets such a wider range of color. Color does so much more. In her work, has many more tasks.
Yes, but Roberta, I wonder if you'd agree with me that with Polly Applebaum, she completely owns her medium, A, and B, it doesn't have that collage other life to it. It's not that the elements in a Polly Applebaum don't function in a way in the world that a terry cloth or a bathrobe do in the world. Therefore, with Polly, it's just an eccentric way of painting, but it's painting.
Well, it's pretty eccentric, though. It's in little pieces on the floor.
It's eccentric. So yeah, we like eccentric.
You know, that's
eccentric's
both,
good.
It's covering the floor, and you have to take care around it. You know, it's very, it's kind of
delicate.
I'm not underestimating
the eccentricity.
Yeah.
But its eccentricity is in the same
but
order
there's more
as
of a
something
balance
like Al Lovelace or quite Al Loving, I'm sorry, and a number of other artists from the sort of 70s onwards who did. You know, eccentric painting through other means, but
is Al using dye? I mean, I think that was one of the interesting things that I felt that the palette choice was a little constrained and limited, and then in a sense that the different iterations of objecthood in mm-hmm. the rest of the show was a kind of way of compensating for the mm-hmm. limited range of palette
choice.
Yeah,
I thought there was actually more going on with color and pictorially in the bathtubs. I mean, the bathrobes.
Yeah.
You know.
But
I was like
given that expanse
like this,
of the space and the towel hangings, I felt that there could have been more. I mean, and maybe there will be more there. I'd hate to see her like not continue like working on it, but also like mixing dyes, you could get earth color.
But I think that's. I mean, I think what she did with this show was open her opportunities.
Yeah.
And she hasn't pursued them yet. I mean, I think there was something kind of. I don't know. I mean, you could say, you know, it's very fashionable right now that art be participatory, so that maybe here's a painting you can wear, here's a sculpture you can, you know, mm-hmm. lounge on. And that's nothing new, but it was like, I guess I'm sort of agreeing with what you say about anxiety. It's like a painter's anxiety mm-hmm. about, you know, all these other things that are going on. But I thought it was, I just thought she was saying, you know, I'm not going to be, I thought there was a quality of rebellion about it. Like she said, I'm not going to stick mm-hmm. to this.
Right. Ara, were you able to engage with the hangings as you would with a painting? Or
absolutely, yeah. I thought they were, and I think the slides actually did justice, at least with the lights out, of their
yes.
you know, their sort of scale, their kind of immersive quality, and the way in which these... you know, ordinary materials have been kind of repurposed. I thought that the other things seemed redolent of a kind of art school experimentation, sort of, you know.
Right.
That didn't quite match the solidity of the hangings.
Okay, well, in our discussion so far, we've moved from post-studio to post-bathroom, and I think it's a good moment to bring in some audience response. So I believe... Marvelous. We have the roving mic. Please wait for that. And so let's take comments first on Matthew Day Jackson. So please hold back if you've got something to say on Anna Betbees. I'm sorry. And I want to hear first on Matthew Day Jackson. Right.
Different configurations of what might be seen, mm-hmm. making up a head, the skull, various parts. And then at the very end, there was something that was bigger, and it looked like tree roots. And I suppose it was aortas and blood vessels. But the fact that it was at a different scale was confusing to me, and it drew my attention. And as forms, I found it very interesting because it seemed very much like tree roots, and it seemed to go beyond just a medical model, to see that the forms in the universe really are connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if it had been made of tree roots. I couldn't figure it out, but it was somehow I was able to relate to that one piece in a way.
It may
that
have been, I think, cast from tree roots, but it was in bronze, I believe.
Okay.
Right. I think all the heads together are one piece.
Right, yes,
yeah.
They are. They are, but yeah. It confused me because, I mean, and it struck me. I wasn't sure what the significance was of it being much too big to fit into the skull the way the other things were.
That's interesting.
Obviously the same size.
Right, interesting.
It's interesting.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Some more comments, yes, on...
When I looked at the Rodin thing, I laughed out loud, and I guess none of you really, and I said, oh, fun art. But I guess none of you saw it that way.
What did you say?
I was
the
coming
word?
From the, I'd seen the Tangley thing on the, from the 60s, maybe that, or, and also walking up that spiky corridor. So, but that escaped you, hey, fun art?
Fun art, right. Well, the venue, of course, had once been a rollerblade disco, so maybe fun.
Well, I think we're talking again about the lack of irony or something. I didn't see it as fun art. I saw it mostly as money art, you know. That. But I think that's an interesting take. I often think that really great art is funny, but I haven't gotten any traction with that idea. But
I'm with you.
You know, there's a kind of joy that. I mean, I think the efficiency of a great work of art is kind of gives you that, but not there.
Hi, this is my first time at a review here, so I hope you don't mind my not following your question, comment, instruction precisely. But what's striking me most is the curatorial or critical move of putting these two up against each other. It almost feels like a lampoon of contemporary art. So Matt Day, Jackson fails like a late capitalist man, and we're all put out by that. And along comes Anna, whose name you'll have to remind me of, the rest of her name. And she fails like a kind of early feminist girl, stuff. And I'm not saying that what I'm opening up is an investigation or an interrogation of their works, but rather of the panel, of the situation we're in, of how these two are put up against each other or what we're to get of it. And I was surprised and kind of fascinated by that.
Okay, well, great. Well, I mean, okay, I they're not...
There's so many ways to fail. New York is a melting pot of fail.
Failing
in part two, we'll look at two more ways, maybe, or we'll redeem ourselves. I would just say that, you know, it's not really curated. It is a throw of the die in a dice in a way. I mean, I mean, we choose our four shows. I make sure the four shows are a good balance. That is not. That there's a good balance of gender and generation and style and form and medium, and at the same time that it's going to get the juices flowing in my particular invited guests, and then I work out well what's going to require the most time and how can we end on a sort of make sure we end on a positive note and blah blah blah, and then I just put it together like you put together a bento box of food. I mean, I didn't really deconstruct the implications of this kind of failure and that kind of failure. I was hoping that I was hoping that two of my panelists would adore Matthew Day Jackson and we'd have a heated debate, but it turned out not to be that way. So I don't think that's curated. I don't think it's usefully subject to a deconstruction, but. Hey, you know, the artists put their stuff out in the world and I put the review panel out in the world. The audience must do what they like with it. There are a lot of hands up, so let me stop gassing away. The back of the hall. And
I essentially agree with what you all said about Matthew Day Jackson, but going off of something Stephen mentioned about how maybe his work needed writing. And I sort of agree with that because I felt that, you know, it's hard to sort of point to the problem without becoming the problem. And I felt that his work was sort of engaged in the spectacle, as Du Bord would call it, the idea that the images that are purveyed to you on television actually replace your reality. Therefore, you're mediated in your own reality. And you guys talked about how his sense of touch always felt mediated, or not there, or fake. And I, you know, I felt that could have been deliberate. And I sort of felt that he was, you know, even though it was spectacular, he still was sort of critiquing it. And you know, I think sometimes as art goers and cultural connoisseurs, I don't know if we consider art to be nostalgic in the sense that it falsifies an emotion for touch and taking your time and sensual qualities. And so when we're presented with something that sort of shows us ourselves as an imperial sort of state, you know, with a lot of money, with a lot of technology, do we repel from that?
Thank you very much. That's definitely an original take, and it's one that, we actually participate in the failure by, or in the intention by our take on it. Okay, very good. How about Anna Betbees then? Let's move on to that show with some audience response. Anybody have a take on the Terry Towels?
Here we go.
Yes, thank you.
I like the Terry Towels when I saw them today. I didn't respond as strongly to the fuzzy little polar bear thing in the middle of the gallery, the hand. When I looked at the Terry Towels, I really was thinking that I'd like to see Joan Snyder get her hands on those Terry Towels at some point and what she would do with them, you know, in terms of bringing paint to that surface, because I think you're right, that's really wide open. The color is electric. The color jumped in my eyes when I walked in the gallery, and I was rather thrilled by some of them.
Cool. Thank you. But why not Bonnard doing a bather on a terry towel? It opens the floodgates. But more comments, more on Anna.
So to speak.
I think that's been done.
Okay. We did it for you. Excellent. So let's put the part, let's get going again. We could dim the lights, ready for part two. Actually,
take a break?
Can we take a break?
We don't take a break now? I didn't know it.
We took our break while they were talking.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Couldn't remember how it worked.
I think logistically, if we all went out in the street and had a cigarette and came back, it would just...
I'm glad my catheter is working.
Yes. Do you continue?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, yes. Actually, why don't we make this a commercial break? And let me mention a couple of good pieces of news for you. Number one is that we meet again on November the 1st in this very room where you can... Oh, no, you can dim the lights. It's fine. We meet again in this room with Stephen Main, Faye Hirsch, and Joan Waltermat. And our shows are a name I was going to look up to remind myself how to pronounce it. So I think I better not make a multicultural fool of myself by mispronouncing a name. But the shows are decided, so go to artcritical.com and you can see them there. How annoying, because I was so thrilled to get the lineup of the shows all agreed upon, and it's the Japanese artist showing at the Sackler Gallery at the Brooklyn Museum. Anyone want to shout out her name correctly for me? Mutu?
Wangechi Mutu.
Wangechi Mutu. Right. Yes, excellent. Wangechi Mutu, sorry. And at the Brooklyn Museum, okay, T.J. Wilcox at the Whitney Museum of American Art, Bruce Pearson at Ronald Feldman Fine Art, and Fran Siegel at Leslie Heller. And also, another commercial plug is that if you go to artcritical.com early next week to check all those details, you can also see our first of the season roundtable discussion among regular contributors to Art Critical, who include, in fact, past and future review panel members, Dennis Carden, Duncan Hanna, Nora Griffin, Christina Key, Vincent Katz, David Carboni, and myself debating the Baltus exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum. So, we now proceed to part two.